to the Gila Members Community Radio Show's Earth Matters, which brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. We aim to inform, challenge, engage, and inspire our listeners. Three hosts alternate weekly shows to bring the listener a broad range of topics and expertise. I'm Donna Stevens, the director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I'm your host for today's show. The Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, or UGWA, is a watershed protection nonprofit group, and we've been around for almost 20 years. We work to protect the Gila River and its tributaries and the Gila National Forest through advocacy and by doing restoration projects. Today's show is about the Keystone Pipeline. My guest is Deborah James, a longtime political activist and a retired teacher who most recently taught at Aldo Leopold High School. Welcome to Earth Matters, Deb.
Thanks, Donna.
First, can you give us a little background about what the Keystone Pipeline Project actually is?
Okay. Early in the millennia, under most public radar, plans were put in place to start extricating petroleum from tar sands. This is petroleum embedded in tar sands. This is not crude oil. From Alberta, Canada, where there were large tar sand basin, and pipe it all the way across the United States to East Texas, where there are refineries in place ready to refine these tar sands. And the idea, of course, when finally this became public, was going to help our energy independence. We'll get more into the realities of that in a bit.
So, can you explain what tar sands are?
Well, tar sands is not crude oil. As I said, most of the good pure crude was extracted by the 1970s and 80s. We skimmed the creme de la creme from the top, and now we have to go for more either deeper petroleum or something that's cheaper to extract than that deep crude. And tar sands was the alternative. The petroleum is deeply embedded in the tar sands. And in order to pull those tar sands out, it requires a chemical process that is quite toxic. I'll explain that to you a little bit more as we get into this topic.
So you said that these tar sands fields are in Alberta, Canada. Are there any in the U.S., or is the fact that they're located in Alberta why we have to have such a long pipeline?
That's my understanding of it.
Okay. So has part of this pipeline already been built?
By 2010, they had already completed a section between Casking, Oklahoma, and Steel City, Nebraska. And about that time, The pipeline came under public radar, and that was the point at which so much protest was put up that they had to bring things to a halt, which is where we have been for the last 2-3 years.
That's what I was kind of wondering, because, I mean, I've read that parts of the pipeline have already been built, and yet then I hear that President Obama has kind of delayed, well, this was months ago, has kind mm-hmm. of delayed the decision about that. And so I'm still a little unclear about exactly where we are in the process. Is the pipeline approved or isn't it approved?
It isn't approved yet, and it has become a political football at this point. There are bills both in the Senate and the House to try to take the power of rejection or acceptance of the pipeline out of the president's hand, where it was a year ago when he did at least put a temporary stop to the program while more environmental study was done. President Obama, of course, in order to avert that action, shifted the responsibility over to the State Department because this is an international agreement. If those bills die, which it's rather expected that they will, both in the House and the Senate, it's expected that a decision will be made in August.
So who actually makes this decision? Will it be President Obama or the State Department? Or I also thought that I heard the other day that there was an EPA study that just came out. So who actually makes the final decision on it?
It's my understanding that it is supposed to be a White House decision, which is why Congress has taken up the cause, because they've been uncomfortable with that. Mm-hmm. And of course, many congressmen, congresswomen are getting pressure from the fossil fuel industry. They would much rather, the fossil fuel industry would much rather have Congress be making that decision than the president, than the State Department.
Yeah, okay. So what are the safety concerns about this project, human safety concerns?
Well, these are big ones. A new report released just recently showed that the Keystone XL would carry the equivalent of 37.7 million cars worth of CO2. That's more cars than are currently driving in California, Oregon, Washington, Michigan, New York, and Florida combined. Now, why do these tar sands risk emitting so much CO2? Number one, in order to get them out of the ground, it has to be blasted out of the ground with this chemical cocktail, a very toxic chemical cocktail that incidentally has to be heated up, and they are using largely fracked natural gas to do that. So we have even more carbon emissions just in that extraction process. Now we have this toxic substance forced through pipeline for nearly a couple of thousand miles across the entire heartland of the United States, and that pathway would be from Alberta, Canada, all the way down through Nebraska, Kansas. We've got sections of Oklahoma all the way down to East Texas, where, of course, rupture is always a risk, and those toxins can go into the water table, any place along the line. The next problem is the fact that once it gets to refineries, this is not a substance that just requires one refining. It requires multiple, a series of refining in order to get it into a usable state. This particular process has a byproduct called pet coke, which is used in coal plants and, of course, as we're all aware, our most dangerous, dirty fossil fuel is coal. And then we still have the burning of the final product in the end. So all of these steps are huge emitters of CO2. The State Department's review of this Canadian pipeline admits that it will have harmful climate effects. And, of course, NASA's chief climate scientist, James Henson, who just recently retired, has warned people for the last several years. In fact, this is where the movement really got started. He said, if we start developing tar sands, it's game over for the climate. Tar sands have become the poster child for the climate movement as more public awareness has come to this issue, even though in and of itself it is a huge issue. It has brought climate issues like these disastrous tar sands productions to the awareness of middle-class Americans through whose backyard this pipeline will travel. It's also important to understand that this is a pipeline that is going through America and not to America. It's expected that in the particular refineries that it's going to, they export the majority of the oil, and it will go to the highest bidder. This is petroleum that will probably be sold to China. The environmental impacts we have had a sneak preview of as at the end of March. ExxonMobil's older sister, the Pegasus pipeline, there has been tar sands production in Alberta, leaving Alberta in about 2006 through a pipeline that has traveled through a different section of the United States. And you probably heard about the fact that there was a rupture in Mayflower, Arkansas, the last week in May, or March, excuse me, that dumped 84,000 gallons of tar sands into people's backyards, into tributaries that will eventually lead into the Arkansas River. The interesting piece to me, of course, we can get into a whole other topic about corporate-owned media, but ExxonMobil is so powerful and influential with their dollars that they were able to establish a no-fly zone over the region where these tar sands were spilled. So most Americans really didn't have an awareness of the immensity of this problem.
And did you say, Deb, that this pipeline spill in Arkansas is from a different pipeline, not the Keystone?
Right. This is Pegasus Pipeline.
So we already have oil pipelines in the U.S.
Yes, we do.
Where is this one going to and from?
I can't answer that question. I didn't follow it to its end. More refineries in, of course, someplace near the seacoast, but I'm not sure if it's the same refineries that they're expecting the Keystone Pipeline to go to. There's one other issue that has become even bigger to me, and that is the fact that these tar sands will be piped to a part of East Texas that has been a refinery area for a long time, very possibly the same pipeline you were just asking about. But this refinery area is totally degraded land at this point. And we all know that the more affluent you are, the more choices you have for the real estate in which you live. The people who have no choice but to live in the cheapest real estate in East Texas are living close to those refineries, and they have already suffered decades of high infant mortality rate, high cancer rates, very unusual health symptoms that's expected to worsen if the tar sands are brought to that area and sent through this multiple refining process. The fact that the environmental movement has now spilled into and cannot be separated from the social justice movement is in our face at this point.
Yeah, so there's people in East Texas and West Louisiana. What do they call that? Like, it has a name, like Toxic Alley or
yes.
Toxic Corridor
yes.
or something.
Yeah.
And where people have been living with these kind of toxic problems for a really long time. And it sounds like with Keystone, it would just get worse.
Yes. Yep. We take for granted, because we live in a beautiful natural area, that even if you don't have very much money, you can go camp in the Gila on the weekend, and you can be in a beautiful place. When you live in a place like the refinery area, like a Toxic Alley, you can't get away from it. You can't take your family for a Sunday picnic anywhere close to you, because everything has been so degraded, the waterways and the land.
Yeah. Well, stay with us. We'll be right back after a break. Welcome back to Earth Matters. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's show, and my guest is Deborah James. Our topic today is the Keystone Pipeline. So, Deb, before the break, we were talking a little bit about some of the safety concerns about the pipeline, and that kind of leads me to my next question, which is that I know that you traveled with a group of activists to Washington, D.C. for protests in February, and I'm wondering if you can tell us about your experiences and who your fellow activists were.
Well, because I had been teaching all of these years, I have never been able to really participate in a national level demonstration, even though I'm teaching kids every day about sustainability issues, about environmental issues. So this was a wonderful opportunity when I saw that 350.org and Sierra Club were organizing this rally in Washington, D.C., hoping it was going to be the biggest rally yet. It followed on the heels of Hurricane Sandy, which was a radicalizer for a lot of Americans to climate issues. So I started searching for a way to get to Washington, D.C. on my fixed income and on also being concerned about my carbon footprint. I didn't want to just be a single person driving all the way across the country, even in my little fuel-efficient car. And the closest bus I could find, busload of folks who were organized to go to D.C., were out of Wichita, Kansas. It turned out to be serendipitously just the best thing that could have happened, because I got a chance to put my finger on the pulse of a new movement that's happening in the Midwest, in the heartland. The people who I traveled with came from the states of Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana. Most of these, with the exception of Illinois, we think of as being red states. We think of these as being people who have been polarized against the whole notion of climate science for as long as it's been in the public eye. It gave me great hope to think that maybe climate change issues were going to become a nonpartisan kind of issue. Another piece of this is that there were several faith-based groups who were attending, and they began filling me in on the fact that now that the pipeline was coming through their backyards, they were recognizing that it was part of a much bigger issue, and they were beginning to recognize that climate change issues are moral issues that need to be addressed by faith-based groups. This really adds a kind of momentum and possibility to the movement. As long as it had followed party lines, as long as it had followed denominational and faith lines, it was a doomed proposition that we were all going to get on the same page to recognize the fact that we have to do something to prepare and mitigate the climate situation that scientists all agree we've created. So on this bus, I got a chance, we had lots of hours, I had 24 hours on the bus to mingle and for me to pick the brains of a lot of people and people to pick my brains. I was the only person from New Mexico on the bus, and so I was an anomaly. And, you know, people wondered if I spoke English. but I loved the fact that regular Americans, you know, the heartland breadbasket Americans, were on this bus, and I got a chance to make some connections with some of those people that I continue now to. We share emails, and we've shared information. We've shared presentations that we've given to different groups, and it feels to me like the movement is growing.
So are you saying that most of the people who were on the bus with you from these Midwestern states were concerned about this issue because they thought it would impact their lives directly?
Yes. Many of the people, we heard about the group that came from Nebraska, from the Steel City area where, as I mentioned, the pipeline, a section of the pipeline went as far as Steel City. The reason that they couldn't go any further was largely because of Nebraska farmers who were the first people to say that, wait a minute, not in my backyard. So yes, to answer your question. I'd like to expand that to say that once we got to D.C., it was further heartening for me because 2 years ago, there was a rally called in D.C. For the Keystone or against the Keystone XL pipeline, which was effective, and 11,000 people showed up, but it was largely white middle-class baby boomers who attended that rally. Now, only 2 years later, more than 40,000 people showed up. It was a sea of people in the Washington Mall. And what I loved was the fact that we baby boomers were a minority. We were a third of the people. And the rest of the people, the other two-thirds, were largely people under 35, families with small children, people representing a variety of ethnicities and racial groups, and holding up their placards saying that they represented other social justice kind of issues. And we could see how people were beginning to connect the dots. That was a very exciting piece.
Yeah, that's an encouraging development because, as you said, it's usually baby boomers at these things because baby boomers are the people who were kind of raised doing protests about different issues. So these people who will be directly impacted by the pipeline going through their backyard, it seems to me that in a lot of these types of projects, they get through because people are promised jobs, and the economy is so bad that, you know, there's so many people who are unemployed or underemployed. So these people must be thinking that the negative impacts of the pipeline will outweigh the good, like getting a job, perhaps. Is that what you experienced?
All of my research tells me that the expectation is if the pipeline goes through, it will create jobs for the duration of the building, the construction of the pipeline. Mm-hmm. And then those jobs will evaporate.
Yeah.
We can't be thinking in the short term anymore.
So is there anything good about this pipeline? For instance, what I hear when I hear its proponents talking about this and other similar types of projects is energy independence. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Well, okay, energy independence. Would the pipeline help us? Well, as I have mentioned, the expectation is the majority of the petroleum that will finally come out of the refineries will be exported. That does not make us energy independent. That makes the oil companies and the refineries have a bigger bottom line. The big point here is it's impossible to fight climate change while simultaneously investing in the dirtiest, most carbon-intensive fossil fuel on the planet. New clean energy sources are critical, and we can't cancel them out with dirty energy options, especially when they're going to be exported. So as far as energy independence goes, I keep hearing the proponents of Keystone saying, well, this is going to lead us to be energy independent by 2035. That means that all of the oil will be, rather than purchased from foreign companies, well, this is still foreign, we'll be purchasing it from our neighbor Canada. And somehow that strikes people as being a little bit more palatable than getting it from the Middle East or from Indonesia. However, at what cost? That's what keeps coming up as the big question. It's important to understand that the oil industry has been subsidized by our government since the period between World War I and World War II. And I looked up an exact date and couldn't find the point at which those subsidies were put into place. But in recent years, between $10 and $52 million annually are subsidized by taxpayers to the petroleum industry, which is making... They're making huge profits. They don't need those subsidies anymore. And it's given them a huge amount of power. It's important from most people who are involved in the climate movement to think about shifting subsidies. If we're going to keep subsidies, let's shift those to alternative non-fossil fuel sources. And that can help push us towards energy independence. Many experts, including Paul Hawken, who's been vocal about the situation we find ourselves in for decades now, believe that we could be energy independent by this method by 2050. Yep, that's 15 years later than we might be if we were dependent on that fossil fuel. But think about the reduction in our carbon footprint and our carbon emissions between now and then.
And it seems to me that if we did become energy independent by 2035, that would be kind of a short-lived phase because, I mean, there is a finite amount of oil on the earth. And at least so far, we have an unlimited amount of sunshine and wind and some of those other alternative energies.
Absolutely. We're kind of talking about the three little pigs approach to energy independence here when we look at fossil fuels as a way of making us independent. It would only work for the short term. We really need to be taking our lead from countries like Germany, even India, even China are thinking ahead and building their house of bricks, as we would say. At least the three little pigs would say.
Okay, Deb, can you talk a little bit about the hearings that happened last week, the EPA hearings?
They were held in Nebraska. I kept getting wonderful emails from all of my Midwestern new friends about busloads of people who were preparing to embark for the hearings. They were planning on filling the hearing hall and filling the space outside the hall to exercise their political will. At the hearings, the EPA submitted their comment letter. And the two big points of their comment letters were that tar sand spills pose risks to water and to health. And they criticized the route of the pipeline that crosses the Ogallala Aquifer. Being the water person that you are, Donna, I'm sure you can recognize why this would be a huge area of concern.
Yeah, I mean, the Ogallala Aquifer is it's a huge kind of an ancient aquifer that supplies a lot of water to Midwestern states. And if anything happens to it, I mean, that's our water supply.
That's right. It topples the agricultural industry that we are dependent on in
right.
the Midwest.
So the EPA's report and their hearings talked about how tar sands pose a risk to both water and human health. So these hearings were held in Nebraska, presumably because Nebraska would be really impacted by this project.
Right, and the squeaky wheel gets the grease. The very first outcries came from Nebraska farmers.
That's really interesting because I don't really think of Nebraska farmers as a particularly radical group of people, although that could just be a stereotype. But I just think of them as being, you know, pretty conservative, like you said, red state. I'm not sure if Nebraska is a red state, but a lot of those Midwestern states, certainly Kansas, are red states. And so it's really encouraging to see them getting involved in issues that are really long term, and that they are kind of seeing through the hype here and realizing that this project isn't really going to benefit them in any way, and it could actually harm them greatly. So I find that heartening, actually, to see that. So we're going to take a break here, and we will be right back. Welcome back to Earth Matters, the show that brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. I'm Donna Stevens, the director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I'm your host for today's show. And with me is Deborah James, and we are talking about the Keystone Pipeline and climate change in general. So Deb, in February, was one of the protesters who went to Washington, D.C., to protest the Keystone Pipeline. And I wonder if you could tell us, Deb, a little bit about what you guys actually did while you were there.
Well, it took us 24 hours to get from Wichita to Washington, D.C. We arrived just as people were assembling on the Washington Mall. We were there for 3 hours protesting, got on the bus, and turned around and drove another 24 hours back to Wichita. What we did while we were there is we first amazed ourselves at looking around at the immensity of the crowd. We had speakers, of course, Bill McKibben kicked things off. He's an activist who has been vocal in the movement, writing books for decades also, and has now started the organization called 350.org, which I imagine a lot of people have heard that statistic that we are unsafe when there's any more than 350,
parts per million.
Parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. And we're in the high 300s at this point. So
we're already over 350.
We're already 350, yeah. And the goal has been of 350.org is to mitigate our lifestyles and what is the activities of the fossil fuel industry so that we can get below that 350 million particulates. I'm not a science person. I'm sorry, Donna.
That's okay.
I'll leave that in your hands.
Like you said earlier in one of our breaks, this isn't only a science issue. This is a moral issue. And you were talking about how the faith-based groups were part of the group of activists because they recognize that caring for our Earth is a moral issue. It isn't just about science. So I think that's a really mm-hmm. important thing that people need to keep in mind.
And it's not just caring for our Earth that people are recognizing. It's talking about caring about the people on the Earth,
right?
All of the species. But the poorest of the poor are affected all over the Earth. We've already, because of rising seas, it's total chain reaction stuff, but because of rising seas, there have already been 2 million people who've been displaced that have had to leave their island homes or their seacoast homes as a result of the melting polar ice caps. People of faith are beginning to recognize that people have to be cared for everywhere. When the projections are that 200 million people will be climate refugees by the end of the century, we've all got to take that into consideration. I think it's very interesting to note that a documentary was recently released called Climate Refugees. I highly recommend watching it, in which they talk about this very issue. And I believe that the target audience are those people who have maybe sat on the edge of their belief, shall we say, that there is really a climate change going on, mm-hmm. To recognize that this is also a homeland security issue. When you've got this many people seeking refuge in places outside of their home nations or their home cities or whatever, security issues come up, and we've got to be prepared for that sort of thing. Right here in our very own Silver City, we live in a pretty ideal place compared to most places in the Southwest Desert because we are at a higher elevation. And we get the rainfall on the mountains, what rainfall there is, what snowfall there is. We're probably in a better position, even though our state climate scientist, Dr. Dave Dubois, has been here twice and will be coming a third time to help us understand what we may face in the remainder of the century. He says we can expect hotter, drier, windier, which, of course, will result in more wildfires and so on. But it's also important to note that our neighbors down the mountain are going to suffer much worse than we are. And those many people are going to have to go someplace. I've read projections that have said that Phoenix, at our current rate, will be uninhabitable by the end of the century. Those people are going to have to go someplace. Mm-hmm. People planning ahead for it can perhaps go back to their East Coast towns. But there will be people who are still there who can't afford to move anywhere. Mm-hmm. They're going to need to go someplace. And I think it's important for those of us locally to begin thinking about how do we prepare a place at our table for people who take refuge in the mountains here? It's not going to be just us. And with our limited water supply, and we don't have the most optimal situation for growing our own food here, how do we make sure that there is enough? We can only do that by beginning now to create the kinds of supportive, non-hierarchical, cooperative communities that we can. We get that base in place now. And the fact that faith-based groups are picking up this issue, I think we have much greater hope now. That needs to spread into neighborhoods where everyone knows that they are supported and cared for, that little old ladies like me know that somebody's got my back and is going to watch out for me as the climate changes more, and that people in the community know that they need to be looking out for other people in their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like you said, it hasn't really gotten too bad here yet, but that could still happen. And in some native communities, like in the Arctic, they've already been impacted quite a bit by climate change. And during one of the breaks, I know you mentioned that when you were in Washington, D.C., there was a group of First Nation people. And can you talk a little bit about what they were saying?
Oh, they were my very favorite speakers at the demonstration. These were the mothers of tribes in Canada who have already been affected by the extraction of tar sands. The tar sands edge native lands, and as they've extracted and infused these toxic chemicals into the tar sands, much of that has leached off into the water. And so their rivers on their lands, on their tribal lands, have already been affected. They're already seeing health effects from this. These women have been at the front of this movement and are asking people in the United States to really take up this issue, whether or not there's ever a rupture in the pipeline along the way. Just at its source, it is already creating problems, and we can only imagine the magnitude of problems if we really get into full production.
Because if these toxic chemicals are leaching into the groundwater, they're also going into the rivers, and people are fishing in these rivers, and I would imagine that there are sources of drinking water for these people as well. So This isn't some theoretical problem in the future. It's happening today already to them. And it just hasn't happened to us yet because we don't have the whole pipeline yet. But, I mean, I know a retired plumber who said, the first law of plumbing is that everything leaks. And that's as true of our water pipes as it is of the XL of the Keystone pipeline. So, I mean, everything leaks. Accidents happen.
That's right.
And so it's inevitable that sooner or later something will happen, and it will affect people's health and the environment and our drinking water. And you were saying earlier that there already has been a spill in Arkansas and that we don't really know the full impact of it because ExxonMobil has been able to keep the media out of that area largely. Although I actually did see only one photo, and it was like oil going down the street in a residential neighborhood. And, I mean, can you imagine if you lived there what that would do to you?
Absolutely. And isn't it wonderful that we live in the age of cell phones with cameras and the internet, where people can post the things that we would not normally get an opportunity to take a look at.
Right. Yeah. So I wanted to go back to the issue of energy independence a little bit, because I've heard people talk about energy independence tied in with the price of gas. So when you go to fill your car at the gas station to fill your tank, people think that if we were energy independent, that gas prices would drop. But I don't believe that that's true at all, because oil is a globally traded commodity and the price is set globally. So it doesn't matter if your oil comes from just outside of Silver City. I mean, the price is still, it's still high because, let's face it, these energy companies want to maximize profits for their shareholders and their CEOs. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't really matter where your oil comes from. It's going to be expensive because it's a dwindling commodity, and people are willing to pay big dollars for it. For instance, in Canada, which is energy, my understanding is that Canada is energy independent, they still pay really high prices because that oil is traded globally. And like you were saying, this oil from the Keystone might end up going to China. And so it's a little hard to understand how that would actually benefit us. I mean, we get all of the negative impacts of the pipeline and the tar sands extraction, but we don't really benefit from the oil. So it's kind of a lose-lose situation for Americans in the heartland.
I think it's been sold to us as a means for lowering prices because it costs less to extract this dirty petroleum than using other extraction methods. But I think you're absolutely correct. From everything I've read, the evidence suggests that during the last election, when many Republicans criticized the current president about not lowering the gas prices, it became obvious that he really doesn't have that much control over what the gas prices are.
Right.
But another piece of that, I think, Donna, is that there are many people in the climate movement that would like to see gas prices not just stay high, but get higher, making it difficult to purchase gasoline. I've heard this argument from many activists. If the price is high enough, then maybe we will cut down our consumption and start moving to using public transportation, which of course is very poor in this country overall, that we'll be seeking more public transportation opportunities. People will be riding their bicycles more. The argument that I have often had against that is the fact that who will be most affected by that? And that's the poorest of the poor. Just taking into consideration that here in Grant County, you don't see that many brand new cars. That's because most of us can't afford brand new cars. You and I both drive our older cars, and we're probably going to drive them right into the ground. And fortunately, we have cars that are pretty fuel efficient. But a lot of people are driving cars out there that they can't even afford to have tuned up enough so that they're more energy efficient. They were bought in an era when 12 miles to the gallon was status quo. And a lot of truck driving, pickup trucks, which get very poor gas mileage, those people are going to be incapacitated, rural people that can't get to a public transportation line and who can't afford fuel-efficient vehicles are going to be first affected.
That's right. We'll talk some more about some of the impacts that this Keystone Pipeline could have locally and nationally as well. So stay with us, please. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Earth Matters. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's show, and my guest is Deborah James, a longtime activist and a retired teacher from Aldo Leopold High School. And we are talking about the Keystone Pipeline and climate change in general. So, Deb, can you please tell us what are the next steps for this pipeline, for the Keystone Pipeline? What's the next thing coming down the pipeline, so to speak?
Well, because the White House is expected to make a decision in August, we're watching now to see what happens in Congress with these two bills that I mentioned before. And we've got to begin getting those on the radar. The fossil fuel industry is obviously pushing hard on Congress to take this out of the hands of the White House. And I think it's important for us to exert our political will and say we want to keep it in the White House. I'm hoping that we're going to have enough integrity and courage in the White House to do the right thing, which is to reject this pipeline, in spite of what profits can be made for the benefactors of government here.
So do most activists who are opposed to the pipeline feel that we have a better chance if the White House makes the decision versus Congress?
That's what I'm hearing.
Okay. So fewer politicians to buy at the White House, or?
Many Americans have lost a lot of faith in Congress, and who's really got the ear of a majority of Congress people, especially in the House. So I think that there is more fear that the capability of being bought is out there, mm-hmm. as opposed to the White House, where at least we're hearing the talk. Now we need what was stated in the State of the Union address by President Obama in his second term. We need to see him walk the walk. And yeah. I appreciate the fact that it's got to be a hard one. There's a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. But I'm among many people who are hoping that he will do the right thing here.
Yeah.
So while that's going on, we have to seize the day. The climate movement is gaining momentum. The fact that we have the difference of probably 30,000 people over the just 2 years' time participating in a demonstration against the Keystone XL pipeline is a good indicator. The fact that we now have a faith-based movement going on, that's also a good indicator that this is the time. This is the time to really exert our political will and let our leaders know that we need the right decision, our rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline as just one piece of the climate issue. That needs to happen immediately. It's something that we do have control over, that policymakers can do something about. So we've got to exert the pressure to do that. We can't do anything about more frequent and robust hurricanes and other weather occurrences, but we can do something about whether or not a pipeline gets put in the ground that has the potential for being highly toxic.
It's kind of like if the people lead, the leaders will follow type of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, good old Margaret Mead tells us that never doubt that a small group of concerned citizen can change the world. Indeed, it's mm-hmm. the only thing that ever has.
Yeah. So why do you think it has taken so long for so many people to get concerned about the pipeline and about the climate issue in general?
All of us who have been working in the climate movement have been frustrated about this for a long time, and there's been a lot of discussion and blame laid out there. Over the years, I've heard a lot of blame put on Americans, especially for wearing blinders, for being addicted to all of the products that petroleum can provide for people to make their lives easier. But I'd like to remove blame, and I especially love the words of Dr. Lycerowicz, who was interviewed by Bill Moyer in January, in one of his I wish I could tell you the title of the program. It was a January 12th Bill Moyer's program. But Dr. Lycerowicz is the director of climate communication for Yale University. And he had a very compassionate view of why there are six different Americas looking at climate change and why it has taken us so long to get on board. And I guess I'd have to boil down his comments. If I may paraphrase, I hope he won't be upset with my interpretation of it. But and saying that the oil industry took its lead from the tobacco industry. During my growing up years, this huge, very profitable organization, industry, I should say, called the tobacco industry, put so much money into the media that they were able to have advertisements in every glitzy magazine out there, on television, when television was becoming popular, really up until the 1980s, in movies that made cigarette smoking look cool and sexy. And by the time the Surgeon General finally came out with the statement that cigarettes or tobacco products could be hazardous to your health, there were so many people addicted to tobacco that they weren't going to pay a huge amount of attention. How many people do you think read that little warning every time they pick up their snuff or their cigarettes? Not being unintelligent, the fossil fuel industry paid close attention to that kind of media control and have done the same thing. They have made us a nation addicted to cars. And they've also been very successful in making us a society of consumers. As a public school teacher, I am here to tell you that it became very apparent to me in just reading through textbooks that my job was really to create a product, and that was good consumers that could support the economic system that we have in place. And part of being a good consumer means that every person of driving age in a family has their own vehicle. It's created wonderful profits for the fossil or for the automobile industry, not to mention all the fuel that has to go into those vehicles. It's kept things rolling for a long, long time. What we need to be compassionate about is no matter how we try to raise our children, we can't override the influence that the media has or that public school education has. And I'm not cutting down public school education as an educator. Of course, I think it's absolutely perfect and wonderful that we have this in place. It's democratic. It makes it possible for everybody to have a chance at education. I think we need to be really careful about making sure that our focus is one in helping people to be the best that they can be, to evolve as a species and to be able to sustain ourselves in a loving sort of way with one another on the planet. Right now, I'll stay on this little school topic right now because this is an issue that is really important to me. As I was pointing out to Kyle earlier today, the way our system is set up in this country is that we have standards and benchmarks for education that kind of set the guidelines for what is taught from kindergarten through 12th grade. And because there is so much pressure for teachers to get kids to pass tests that cover these different standards and benchmarks, that's all they have time to teach. And there are currently no standards and benchmarks. I should change that. I'll tell you in a minute what's happening. But there have been no standards and benchmarks for sustainability education or climate change. We are currently at a place where all states are going to be adopting a national common core set of standards, educational standards. And I've been recommended to a group that will be working on creating those standards here in New Mexico to focus on getting sustainability and climate issues woven through the curriculum. If those are in place, teachers will be required to teach those subjects. And that is the only way that we're going to have a society that is prepared for the 21st century. Right now, we have an educational system that's preparing kids for a world that existed when we grew up and is not necessarily going to be in place when they get to be adults. So it's imperative that we get this into place. It is also imperative that people take some control back and recognize the fact that there is too much influence through the media on helping to make good consumers out of our children. No matter how you raise your own children in a conscious way, it's hard to override somebody convincing your kids that they want Fruit Loops for breakfast. And you get that pressure every time you go to the grocery store. And then it gets to be your kid is a junior in high school ready to take the driver's test, and your kid says, but I have to have a car. All of my friends have cars. We've created such a chain of consumerism in this country just by the fact that we've been innocent about the fact of where our influences come from. So taking charge of those influences is going to be a big one, but I think that the more local we become, the more dependent we are on local businesses and in improving our local communities, the less we're going to be consumed by consumerism.
It's true. I mean, I grew up in a big city in Chicago. I lived there for the first 28 years of my life. I didn't own a car. I didn't even get my driver's license till I was 28 because I didn't need a car. I couldn't afford one. I could afford public transportation, and it was very good there. But here locally, this is a big state. It's a very rural state, and there's really no public transportation to speak of. So what are some of the local alternatives that we have right here in southwest New Mexico that would bring us closer to a more sustainable energy system?
We have everything available to us from Mother Nature right here. We've got one of the best places on the planet for solar possibilities. The eastern part of the state has fantastic wind possibilities, and we also know there's a corridor south of us where they've recently put up the wind farm between Hatch and Deming. The possibilities are out there. Without public policy in place to support subsidizing renewable energy, we can't move too far forward. Unfortunately, right now where we are with solar is that, yeah, we can build our passive solar homes, and I'll take advantage of that, but only the affluent are able to put photovoltaic systems on the roofs of their houses. And then, unfortunately, because of the electrical monopoly we have here, the energy monopoly that is getting its power from a coal-operated plant in the Four Corners area, the best that most photovoltaic owners can do is sell back their electricity to that energy monopoly. So some policy needs to be shifted so that direct transmission can begin to happen. Transmission lines and an old grid system have been a big problem throughout the country, and there hasn't been a huge amount of energy put into to changing that, and that's something that we can use our political will for.
Can you tell me, Deb, what are some of the things that people can do if they want to find out more about this issue? I know you've mentioned the 350.org a couple of times. Is that a good source for information?
Yeah, it is a good source, and I'd say that the Sierra Club is another site. SierraClub.org is another site to go on if you want to find out information specific to the Keystone XL pipeline. Those are two really good sources to go to.
Okay.
There's tremendous amount of reading out there that I wouldn't have time to mention. But, you know, if you just have a site that you want to check into on a regular basis, I would say that commondreams.org is a good place to get pretty fair news. I'd also say that our local radio station that you're listening to right now, their Tuesday and Thursday program, is a great way to stay informed.
Thank you. All right, I think that wraps up the show for today. So thanks for joining us, and
thank
we'll
you, Donna.
See you next week on Earth Matters.